Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, to ask a question, press star one on your touch-tone phone and record your name at the prompt. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Vivian White. Thank you. You may begin.
Hello out there, everyone. This is Vivian, as you said, from the Night Sky Network here at the Astronomical Society of the Pacific in San Francisco, California. Tonight we're excited to be hosting Dr. Eileen Yankst from the Planetary Science Institute. She's a lead scientist on several of the instruments on the Mars Science Lab, better known as the Curiosity Rover. So if you're hearing my voice now, hopefully that means you've called the right number. Let's quickly make sure you're looking at the right slides also. If you don't have the slides up in front of you, you can see them online at www.astrosociety.org/NSN Telecon. That's astrosociety.org/NSN Telecon. And if you have any problems along the way, feel free to email us here at nightskyinfo@astrosociety.org. So just for a moment, before we hear from Dr. Yinks this evening, I want to take a second and acknowledge and thank Marnie Berenson for her many, many years of service and with the Night Sky Network. She's retiring this month, and you are all here listening to this telecon because of a vision that Marnie and her colleagues had about 10 years ago, that NASA could work to support the outreach efforts of us amateur astronomers within our own communities. And Marnie's retiring, as I said, at the end of this month, and we all owe a huge debt of gratitude to her hard work and dedication. And she's here with us tonight, so we just wanted to say thank you, Marnie. Marnie, do you have a second to say hi to everyone?
Aw, Vivian. Thank you. Well, I do have to say that it's been a real honor to have all of you folks as partners in building the Night Sky Network. I love hearing all your stories of the amazing work that all of you do with your communities, and of course, how you've used the Night Sky Network to transform your club and its outreach. I also have to say that Vivian's been the most dedicated and delightful colleague anyone could hope for. She's my perfect successor, so I look forward to seeing you all out there under the stars.
Marnie, you're great.
Take it away.
And you may just find her stopping by your star parties one of these days. Thanks, Marnie. That's very kind. So I'm really excited also to introduce Dr. Yinks. But before I do, let's take a minute to see who else is out there listening on the line. Operator, if you could open up all the lines briefly and just all of you out there, if you want to tell us your name and where you're calling from.
All lines are now open.
Jürgen Wustrow, Alcuna, Pennsylvania.
Mary West from New Jersey.
Pam.
Joan Chamberlain from Maine.
Jim Fox, Keene, New Hampshire.
Cliff Ashcraft from AAI, New Jersey.
Stuart Myers from AAI in New Jersey as well.
Ted Forte from Sierra Vista, Arizona.
Dave Udell from Door County, Wisconsin.
Willie Yee from New Paltz, New York.
Patrick O'Brien from Terry and O'Brien Astronomy Club.
Rob Burgess from Brunswick, Maine.
David Fields, hello from Knoxville, Tennessee.
From Reading, Pennsylvania.
Ron Burke from Maine.
Jim Benton, NDAS, Ohio.
Barry Ron Gallagher from the land of the pineapple, Hawaii.
And Carol Wood from Harriman, Tennessee.
Noah Frere from Knoxville, Tennessee.
William Mosky
from Rockford, Illinois.
John Cox from Mount Rest Astronomical Observatory in South Carolina.
John Sillison.
E. Lott from Atlanta, Georgia.
Kathy Santis, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Amateur Astronomers Association of Pittsburgh.
Joseph Dolan, Grants Pass Astronomers, Oregon.
John Sillison, ASGH, Connecticut.
Thanks for all the work, Barney. This is Patrick O'Brien from Omaha.
Patrick.
Thanks so much, everybody. Maybe we'll close up the lines and get started.
Well, this is Roger Macklin from Orion in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, but I'm calling from Emmitsburg, Maryland, actually.
It sounds like we have half of Tennessee on the line tonight.
From New Jersey.
Victor Solomon from Southwest Florida Astronomy Society.
All right, Alyssa, if you want to close up the lines, that would be great.
All lines are now muted.
Thank you so much. It is so great to hear from everybody. Thanks for calling in tonight. If this is your first teleconference with us, welcome. You just need to follow along with the slides, and we'll have time for question and answers at the end of the talk. I also want to remind everyone to stick around after the presentation and the questions, because we'll be giving away the International Atlas of Mars Exploration to one lucky listener tonight, and we'll have more on that later. But now, without further ado, let me introduce you to our speaker tonight. Dr. Eileen Ningst wears many hats. She's the director of the Wisconsin Space Grant Consortium, a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, and, of course, a senior research scientist at the Planetary Science Institute, where she's working on the Mars rover. Quite a few instruments on the Mars rover, it turns out. And on a side note, being from Wisconsin, I also hear she occasionally wears cheese on her head. It's one of her hats. Dr. Jinks is probably more familiar with Mars than just about any other Earthling, having previously worked on the Mars Atmospheric and Geologic Imaging Team at the University of Arizona and as a geologist on the Mars Pathfinder mission, among others. The Curiosity rover has sparked everyone's interest. It was exactly 4 months ago now, with all the excitement of the sky crane landing and the self-portrait sent from this faraway world. But Curiosity is more than just a pretty picture, and we're excited to hear tonight about the science discoveries being made in these first few months. Welcome, Dr. Yinks. We're really glad to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks very much. That was a rather stunning introduction. I know a lot of people who know a lot more about Mars than I do, but I'm very grateful to be here. And let me just do a sound check, make sure everybody can hear me okay.
It's actually a little bit blurry for me. Is there, I'm not sure if there's a way to change that.
Okay. Was it giving problems before?
It wasn't. It's kind
okay.
of bouncy.
All right. What I will do is let me start the talk, and I will try and switch phones in the middle, and maybe that will make a difference. And if it doesn't, we'll just go with what we have.
Well, you know, it just got a little bit better, so maybe that was it.
All righty then. Okay.
Thanks.
excuse me, I am... We're going through a major temperature switch in Wisconsin. We've gone from 20s to 40s to 20s to 40s, and it's snowed when it's 40. And anyway, so I'm getting over something, but I will do my best not to clear my throat into your ear too often. So let's jump right on to slide two. On slide two, you'll see an artist's conception of the Curiosity rover. And the Curiosity has a scientific goal to explore and assess a region on Mars as a potential habitat for life past or present. And that includes looking at not just the biological potential, but that biological potential in context. That means geology and geochemistry. I am a geologist, and so that's my main role on this mission, is to provide the geologic context for the possibility of not just habitability, but the ability of an area to retain a record of that habitability. So moving on to slide three. This was our target. This is Gale Crater. It's not quite 100 miles wide. And you can see on the bottom image, this is a topographic image of Gale Crater. And see, there's a really large mound right in the middle of it that has the informal name of Mount Sharp. And the reason that Gale Crater was selected as the landing site over something like a five-year period of debate and discussion is that Gale Crater has this mound in the middle of it. And this mound is actually layer upon layer upon layer of sedimentary rock. Sediment is important because it means the rock was not formed there. There were bits of rock that were broken off somewhere else, transported to this area, deposited, cemented, and then it happened again. Another stack happened on top of it. So if anybody's been to the Grand Canyon, the same idea applies. And the reason that an area like this is so interesting and instructive to geologists is because those stacks record different environments. Every different layer records a different set of environmental conditions. And the deeper down you go into those layers, the further back in time you can look. So with a stack nearly 5 kilometers high, that's a long distance into the Martian past that a geologist is able to look. Also, you can see on the left, we think that inside that ellipse, which is the landing ellipse, is the debouchment, the emptying out of an alluvial fan, which we believe was fluvial deposits coming down into the valley and emptying out into the valley. And as we know from previous missions, most specifically Opportunity and Spirit, there is water, there was water, and water is one of those things that we believe is necessary for life as we understand it. So moving on to slide 4,
I was just going to let you know that your sound is a little bit hard to hear, and I was wondering if you you had offered to call in on a different line. That might be the way to go if you have the time.
Sure. Why don't we go on to slide 5 then, as I've addressed some of this already, and we can talk a little bit about what the rover looks like. So on slide 5, you'll see an engineering cartoon of the rover with its complement of instruments. The rover is about 2,000 pounds and about the size of a car, about the size of a Mini Cooper. So this is by far the largest piece of equipment, moving piece of equipment that we've ever sent to Mars. And I'm going to switch phones here. You can tell me if this is
better or worse. Better or worse?
Oh, much better. Thank you.
All right, no problem. So just for comparison, the MER rovers were about the size of golf carts, so that gives you an idea of how much larger this rover is. And the reason it is because it contains its own laboratory. It's unique in that respect. So the previous rovers had sort of reconnaissance instruments, you might even say triage instruments. This one contains some laboratory instruments inside the body of the rover. So let's look at slide 6. Rather than an engineering diagram, this is, again, an artist's conception, but it gives you an idea of all the science instruments, and there are a bunch of them. So starting from the upper left, the mast cam, these are the visual cameras. There are two eyes. One gives better resolution than the other, but they're separated in such a way that you can see in stereo. Going down from there, the REMS booms on the mast. That gives us air temperature, pressure, and so on. So it's our weather station. Dan is looking for subsurface hydrogen. Around the corner, you see SAM and Kemin. These are the internal, the body laboratory instruments for samples, looking for isotopic chemistry and mineralogy. The MARTI is mounted on the bottom of the rover. This was the descent imager, and I'll show some pictures from that shortly. On top of the arm, or at the end of the arm, excuse me, you'll see what's called the turret, or actually from some engineers, because of its shape, the cheese head. It has a drill, a scoop, brushes, and sieves, and these are all sample preparation instruments. You have the MOLLE instrument. That's a microscopic imager. That's my instrument. That's the one that I'm the deputy principal investigator on. A little around that, you'll see the Alpha Proton X-ray Spectrometer, or the APXS. That gives us rock chemistry. And then away from the arm and going back up the rover, you have radiation detector, the RAD instrument, and then on the top, and it looks like it should be a single eye, but that's actually the ChemCam. And the ChemCam is a chemistry camera. The idea here is that the ChemCam literally zaps rocks with a laser, and that gives off rock plasma. Basically, it turns the surface into a plasma. And that plasma is something that we can measure at a distance. APXS we actually have to put down or get very close to the surface that we're trying to measure. The LIBS, the laser on ChemCam allows us to zap that rock from a distance and still be able to get some chemistry from it. So moving on to slide 7. This is an image taken by the Marti Descent Imager. And this is really, I think, an iconic image. This is the rover descending from the sky crane. And before the sky crane has been released, this is a heat shield that's dropping away from the rover. Slide 8. This is the dust plume that got kicked up as the rover is coming down. And as a geologist, this was kind of an exciting moment because it stripped dust from the Martian surface. When I show you some pictures of the actual landing, this is a big deal because it's the first time we've actually seen rocks that weren't covered with dust on the surface. So on slide 9, this is our very first image. It's one of those things where everybody was crowding around the screen and trying to figure out what they were seeing, what they were looking at. Of course, we're immediately looking at it as data and trying to interpret what we're seeing. But you can see topography in the back. The reason this looks a little warped is because the first images that were taken with the hazard cameras. Hazard cameras are fisheye lens cameras, and they're designed simply to give us immediate situational awareness when we're driving or after a drive or before a drive. And the idea is simply hazard avoidance. We want to know if we're getting towards something that the wheels can't handle. But it was also sort of a these are the quickest cameras that we have. The images that they take have the least amount of memory that they require. And this is a quick and dirty first look. Are the wheels all intact? Are we sitting high and dry on the ground? And that's exactly what this slide shows. So slide 10 is just a title slide. So I'll be talking about some of the first observations we've done at the landing site, which was dubbed Bradbury Landing in honor of Ray Bradbury. Next slide is slide 11. This is a Masscam 34 mosaic of the mountain in the middle of the crater, Mount Sharp. You can see every place that you see gray rocks to the right, these are scours from the descent. And then you can, of course, see the rover shadow as well. These are mosaics. That means we've taken a bunch of different pictures and stitched them together. This is the most efficient way of getting the most data out of the camera. Next slide, slide 12, shows a close-up of one of those scour marks. This actually has a name. It's Goulburn scour. They all have sort of dragon-type names, except for this one. This is bedrock that was exposed by the landing engines. And again, as a geologist, woohoo, we've got rocks that aren't covered in dust that makes it difficult to judge anything from morphology to geochemistry. Slide 13, for those of you who like spectra, I'm going to point out I did my first degree in physics and astronomy, and one of the hardest things it was for me in moving on to a geological sciences degree was to kind of reverse the spectra. We tend to look at reflectance spectra in geology rather than emission spectra, so I'm just going to point that out right now. This, as a matter of fact, is an intensity count, so it should look a little bit more like what you'd expect. So ChemCam tends to give us something that astronomers are a little more used to. This was the first rock that we shot with ChemCam, and I love using this word because we actually did shoot it, as opposed to, you know, you say you shoot something with a camera. No, we actually shot this rock with a laser. It was pretty cool. So this is the first rock that we did. It's, a little less than football size. It's not very large. It's kind of hard to get the scale idea here. But you can see that this is relatively, you know, it's got a decent amount of iron, decent amount of titanium, magnesium. This is probably a basaltic rock. There are a lot of heavier metals in this rock, and that would suggest that this is probably basaltic. The morphology, the shape of the rock suggest that as well. Fine-grained, kind of these smooth, flat facets ending in these sharp edges. Pretty typical for a lot of rocks that we saw at other sites like Spirit. But a good first rock to take a picture of. Next slide is slide 14. This is taken by a support camera that the ChemCam has. This is the RMI, and it takes a very high-resolution black and white images of the shots that the LIBS, the laser, takes. So you can see before and after on the left. This is the target Beachy that we shot on Sol 19. On the left is the rock before. On the right, you can see five little dots in a row. These are LIBS shots. These are shots by that laser. Slide 15. This is another probably basaltic rock. This is called Jake Matejevich. This was named after a JPL engineer who died shortly after landing. And this is some of the first really good imaging that was done by the MOLLE camera. You can see these beautiful fluted edges suggests that you had some aeolian or sand weathering of this rock. You can see one side is more stripped than the other, which would suggest the wind direction. But you can also see really, really fine grain in there. You can see a couple of things that might be sticking out and little grains in there. So this may be a little bit more of an interesting rock than we originally thought. We were looking for something that we wouldn't be able to see grains in at all. But there are a couple of places that are sticking up here that suggest we might be looking at some grains in here. And that's exciting for a geologist because it takes a while for a grain to grow. If anybody ever did the experiment where you took some paper clips and put them on a string and you stuck them in a cup into sugar water and the sugar started to sort of granulate around the paper clips, that takes a while. It takes crystals a while to grow, and that's true in a magma as well. Any kind of liquid, it takes a while for those crystals to grow. So anytime you get a rock that is not fine-grained, that is coarse-grained, you've got actual crystals that you can sample and try and figure out what the magma was like that they grew in and how they did. So slide 16. This is that same rock studied by several other different instruments. The APXS, that's the rock that can give us the instrument that can give us elemental abundances. And then ChemCam, again, you can see we've tried to, on the right, you can see those little dots again from the LIBS laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy is what that stands for, and that's the laser. Again, you can see here the composition is similar to alkaline basalts. So you melt the mantle partially, and you get an alkaline basalt. And the interesting thing here for us is that if you have a terrestrial planet, it always surprises me, and yet it shouldn't, that it has very similar processes planet to planet. And when you have similar processes, you get similar products. Slide 17. So this gives us an idea of where we started and where we're headed. Bradbury Landing is over here on the left, and then our destination is over here on the right. And even if you're not a geologist, it's pretty clear from this image that we have landed near an area where three different types of rocks or three different types of units, perhaps, have come together. We called it a triple point. We hesitated in calling it that because that really is a term of physics. We couldn't come up with anything else. The idea, though, is that you have an area here where you get three different units coming together. So you get a really good bang for your buck if that's someplace that you go. And the best drive looks to be actually to Mount Sharp. The best drive looks to be behind us. So one of the reasons our destination here is called Glen Elg. It has geologic significance, but more importantly, it's a palindrome. It's the same forward and backward, and I think the idea was that we would go this way and then we would turn around and go back. So really bad geologic humor there. So slide 18. I love this picture because this was taken from orbit. This is a picture from the high-rise camera on MRO, on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. You can see some of the scour marks in this image, and it's a stretched image. The color is stretched, but you can see some of the scour marks. You can see the rover itself as this gleaming white set of pixels. You can also see the tracks of the rover, which is just stunning. So, slide 19. This is another title slide. So I'm going to talk about now is our discovery of what's called a conglomerate. And I know I don't know how much geology some of you have, so I'm just going to assume little knowledge. And hopefully those of you who are aware of what I'm talking about can kind of just look at the pretty pictures. But let's move on to slide 20. So, again, this is the area that we've been. So you're familiar now with those scour marks. That gives you a touch point. That's Bradbury Landing. You can see Glen Elg is noted as well. The places where you see arrows are places where we saw outcrops of conglomerate. An outcrop is important to a geologist because it is rock that was formed in situ as opposed to loose pebbles lying across the surface. Outcrops are important because they give you the rock in context of formation, whether it is igneous formation that is formed from a liquid, from a magma, or sedimentary formation that is the pieces got there, but that's where they cemented. So an outcrop is important for context. And a conglomerate is important as a rock that has larger pebbles within a fine grain matrix. And to make a conglomerate, you have to do two things. You have to beat up a larger population of pebbles typically in fluvial environments, in a water environment, to the point where they start to round, the corners get knocked off, the sides start to smooth out, and then you have to transport those pebbles someplace where they can be embedded in a finer grained matrix and then buried and cemented. So that's a lot of process for another planet. The Earth is incredibly geologically active compared to other planets. And it's a big deal that Mars had this much action going on. So let's go on to slide 21. You can see the Goulburn scour. This was the first look at the underlying bedrock, as I mentioned. But this looks from a distance as a conglomerate. And if we move to the next slide, 22, this is one of the best pictures. This is a conglomerate link. And not only can you see, if you want to scan in a little bit, it doesn't look like online you have quite the same resolution that we do in the full-res pictures. But if you scan in, not only can you see these big pebbles sticking out, these multi-centimeter diameter pebbles sticking out, but you can also see the loose pebbles that have been rounded as well that are kind of littering the surface here. So slide 23. This is another one of those conglomerates. And I would encourage you, if you're not getting the kind of resolution you want, I want you to know that all of these images are available at jpl.nasa.gov. All of the data, all of the images have been released. They were released almost immediately. The MOLLE images are released immediately. Some of the other data, the ChemCam data and so on, some of it's released right away. Some of it has to be calibrated first, and then it's released. But pretty much everything is released immediately or soon thereafter on jpl.nasa.gov. And so if you want to see higher resolution images, please go there and download to your heart's content.
This is Vivian. I also just want to mention, if you download the original PowerPoint, I think those are much higher resolutions than the one we'll see online.
Oh, terrific. Good. All right. So on slide 24, this is a topographic image, an elevation map of the landing ellipse. And this gives you an idea why we're seeing a conglomerate. An alluvial fan is going to round pebbles. It's going to round gravels and then transport them fluvially and then dump them out higgledy-piggledy across the surface. Where the finer grain stuff comes from, we're still working on. But the alluvial fan is pretty much a dead giveaway. So let's move on to slide 25. This is my shameless plug for my own instrument, the MOLLE instrument. I'm actually a co-investigator on the MASTCAM and the MARTI, but I'm deputy PI for MOLLE, so she's really my baby. So let's move on to slide 26. Slide 26 shows a close-up of the turret taken by MASTCAM and gives you an idea of where the instruments are on the turret. And you can kind of see, too, it's kind of flat on top, flat on the bottom, and sticks out in a bunch of ways on the sides, and that's kind of why the engineers were calling it the cheesehead. And I continue to do that just because I'm from Wisconsin, so there. So on the right, that funky rectangle looking at you is the APXS. On the left, slightly tilted at a saucy angle, is Molly. She has a hinge for her dust cover, which is on the top, and then you can see it rounded like a U on the bottom. The circle thing in the middle, that's where the actual lens is behind the dust cover. You also see two little glowing lights, one on each side. Those are our LEDs. We are able to take pictures at night. We can take illuminated pictures. We have regular visible light LEDs, white light LEDs. We also have UV LEDs, just in case anybody brought up a Led Zeppelin poster or something. If any rock decides it wants to phosphoresce, we're going to be able to see that too. So slide 27. One of the jobs of Molly is to be able to support and document other instruments and other hardware. One of the first things we did was do an underbelly pan, and the reason why we did a panorama underneath the rover is because of my old baby Spirit, who got stuck over her last winter, and we believe might have gotten hung up on a rock underneath the chassis. Now we're actually able to image that because Molly is not a fixed focus. It's a variable focus, and so we can focus at any place underneath the belly of the rover. This is another one of those images. I really encourage you to pump these up right up to the finest resolution, because if you look at some of these wheels, not only is the resolution good enough to see some of the nicks and little dents from some of the larger rocks during the landing event, but you can actually see the machining lines in the wheels. The resolution is tremendous, if we do say so ourselves. Slide 28. This is the site that we were at for a really long time to be able to do some of our first-time activities, scooping, sieving, and testing out our laboratory instruments. This is the Rock Nest site. This is the Sand Shadow. And then on slide 29, this is a wheel scuff. This is our first dig into the Martian soil to try and scoop some of it up and put it into our sample acquisition system. Slide 30. This is a beautiful Molly image of coarse sand from the surface of that ripple. You can also see some of these look a little bit rounded. Some of them are almost spherical. And one of the hypotheses for that is that these little spherules are impact spherules. So in a volcano, in a fire fountain of a volcano, you'll get these little spheres that come out of glassy melt, and sometimes they stretch or go teardrop shape in the air. If you have a large enough impact, if you get a decent amount of impact melt, that can happen with impact melt as well. It's been predicted on Mars. This may be the first time that we've actually sampled that in situ. You can see the scoop, our first scoop, looking beautiful on the bottom there. And on the top, that's called the O-tray. That's a place where we can dump out samples and take a good look at them. So slide 31. This is Sam and Kemen data. I admit to not being a geochemist. I'm a geomorphologist, and so I'm more interested in rock shape and rock texture and so on. I'll just mention here that these are, you know, first-time activity things. You're seeing, again, basaltic grains, but you're also seeing evidence for water, sulfates, carbonates, and perchlorates. Sulfates we knew about, carbonates, that's a big deal. All right, so slide 32. I want to give myself enough time to talk about slide 32. Slide 32 shows the self-portrait at Rocknest. I think it's really cool that Vivian actually mentioned the self-portrait as one of the sort of iconic images of the rover. It was assembled from 55 Molly images, shows those scoops in Rocknest, and it also shows the wheel scuff. And I want to point out that this, to me, is particularly special, not just because it was taken by my instrument, because I am the one that shepherded this observation through the process. So the folks that designed the camera about a year ago said, hey, I bet we could take a picture of the whole rover with the Molly. And so they tried it out in the test bed. They set up the sequence. It looked great. I'm like, this is awesome. But you can't just say, hey, guys, let's do this and hand it over to the engineers and have them joystick the thing and say, oh, sure, we'll put it in, you know, in an hour. Anything that we do with the rover, we have to be very careful about. Is it going to damage something? Are we going to have a software getting a new observation into the process takes months. It took me a month to get this vetted, to get this set up for on Mars rather than in the test bed, to get it agreed to by, I think, 6 to 8 different committees that I had to go through. But my gosh, look at the results. This, I think, is one of the coolest pictures we've ever taken on Mars. This is Curiosity rover holding an iPhone in front of her, saying cheese and saying, having a good time, wish you were here. I just love this image. And I'm also going to point out that this image has made me famous, I think, not by name, but this image puts me on the list of people who've been part of a conspiracy theory, because you'll notice that you can't see the arm in the image. And if you go on the web, you'll see that people are saying that we never actually went to Mars because you can't see the arm in the mosaic. Well, you can't see the arm in the mosaic because we worked really hard to pick the pictures that would show the least amount of hardware so that you didn't have this big stick in front of you as you were trying to look at the actual rover. So this was purposeful, but it is now part of a conspiracy theory, so I'm really proud to say that I'm part of a conspiracy theory. So, slide 33, I'm going to just let you kind of scan through these. Slide 34 gives you the ground and air temperatures. You can see there's a pretty decent diurnal jump, which we expected. It's pretty much the same thing we see on the other side of the planet. Slide 35 lets you know that not only is there a diurnal difference, but there are pressure differences from sol to sol. That is a Martian day, a sol. And see, it says each day the pressure varies by over 10%, which is the change in pressure between L.A. and Denver. And that's in one spot on Mars. Slide 36, this is the daily dose of radiation that you'd be getting on Mars. This is why being an astronaut is a considered a high-risk profession. Slide 37, we're looking the ground for hydrogen. There's not a whole lot to say at this point on this, and so I've pretty much put this in for completeness' sake, but I'll let folks peruse that at their leisure. And then slide 38, the SAM inlet can be left open. The SAM is one of those things that we use for samples, but we can leave it open and take samples, ambient samples of the atmosphere, and do some atmospheric gas abundance measurements as well. So a little extra added bonus. Slide 39 is just a title slide, and slide 40 is a geologic map for those who are interested in that sort of thing. This is where we're exploring. Again, you have all of our target names. They're crazy, I know. They're all named after important geologic formations, mostly in Canada. Slide 41, these are the shaler rocks, and they look very, very fine-grained. They look layer upon layer, very fine-grained rocks, which really suggests sediment transport. Slide 42. You can see a diversity in this very same area. So behind us are the shaler rocks. In front of us are these rocks. You see what look like veins, what look like cracks. If you go to slide 43, this is our first brush, and you can see those same cracks close up. And that little inset there is our brush. Slide 44. These are filled fractures. That is, you have a fracture. You have water that has some sort of mineralization in solution. The water comes through. It either evaporates or just passes through and leaves behind the minerals. And that's where you get these veins, both on Mars apparently and on Earth. So this is one of the big discoveries from the rover. And then slide 45, you have these spherules, which suggests that water percolated through pores. So I want to make sure that I stay on time here. The last couple slides, so slide 46 is just a title slide. 47, this is just recently before we had a software error, so this is our first drill site, first time we've taken a bite out of Mars. If you go to slide 48, the last four slides after that are pretty pictures of Mount Sharp, which is, unfortunately for me at least, far in the distance, but certainly beckoning us to get there. So with that, I will close, and I believe the next thing is to open it up for questions. Thanks very much.
Oh, Dr. Yinks, that was wonderful. What a great talk and really incredible pictures. I encourage, if you're viewing this online, definitely take a look at the original PowerPoint that you can download from the Night Sky Network website. So, operator, if you could open us up for questions, that would be fantastic.
Excellent. Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Unmute your phone and record your name clearly. If you need to withdraw your question, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. It will take just a moment for questions to come through. Please stand by.
And I actually have a quick question. You said at some point that they discovered carbonates, and that's a big deal. Could you just say why that's a big deal?
Well, it's not a big deal yet. Carbonates are potentially a big deal because on Earth we tend to think of them as a rock that is associated with life. It doesn't have to be. On Earth, because life is so ubiquitous, it tends to be, but it doesn't have to be. But it's a unique flavor of rock that we haven't seen previously, and so that makes it exciting and sort of an open-ended question, if you like.
And our first question comes from Patrick O'Brien. Go ahead, your line is open.
Well, hello, Dr. Yinks. Thank you very much for a nice presentation. And I'm Patrick O'Brien with the Darien O'Brien Orchestry Club, Astronomy Club, not Orchestry. But I have a question for you. In your professional opinion, I'm almost 60 years old, and is my generation ever going to have the luxury of arriving on Mars? In your professional opinion, and will the person who is first on the Mars planet be an American?
Okay, there were two questions there. My professional opinion, I have to be careful there because I'm not an engineer. So all I can give you is my, you know, my best guess, colored by my own optimism, I think. I think that there aren't currently plans in the next, say, 10 or 15 years, maybe even 20, to send people to Mars. But in the next 30 or 40 years, yes. And frankly, I think if the country decided today that they wanted to get people on Mars in the next 10 or 15 years, they could do it. It's simply a question of priorities. There are many priorities in a democracy, and this is only one. One of the reasons we got to the moon in less than a decade, considering, you know, when Kennedy gave his speech that we were blowing things up on the launch pad on a regular basis, the reason we got there in a decade is because we decided that's what we were going to do, and it was a profoundly high priority for us. There are other priorities right now, but technologically there's not necessarily any deal breaker at this point to stop us. Do I think it's going to be an American? I don't know. Technologically, I think we are still the most advanced as far as both robotic and human exploration. Those things can change, but right now, you know, if they did not change, I would say that we are further ahead as far as human exploration.
Well, thanks a lot, Dr. Yees. And that was a good answer for a geologist, because I personally wanted to become an astronaut and be the first man on Mars. That's why I was asking the question. But I don't think I'll, in my generation, being almost 60, I don't think I'll live until 100 years old.
You never know. I wanted to be the first person on Mars.
Well, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Robert Lyons. Go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor, for your presentation. And my question is, has the sequester affected your day-to-day operations?
For those who may not have heard that, the question was, has sequester affected day-to-day operations? Yes and no. No, in that mission operations is a NASA high priority, and so it's one of the last things to be cut. Yes, because as a scientist, free exchange of ideas is crucial to my being able to do my job, and right now none of us are allowed to travel internationally, and we're not really allowed to do much domestic travel either. All of that has been put on hold. And so the basic currency of my job, which is discussion, debate, has been severely curtailed by that. But day-to-day operations, no one's going to be unplugging the rover anytime soon, I don't think. I hope not, anyway.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from John Haisley. Go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for a great presentation. And of all the rocks you've seen so far, which one would you most like to examine yourself if there were a sample return mission?
Is that you, John?
Yeah, it's me, John. And if we say we can't get you to Mars, if we could bring one back, which one would you pick?
Oh, boy. Of the rocks that we've seen so far, I would have to say probably the shaler rocks. They look a lot like mudstones to me, and if I really wanted to get at habitability, that would be the first place I'd look. Now, that's not necessarily my area of geologic expertise, but speaking as a representative of the full geologic community, I would say probably the mudstones. And, of course, we always have to put those words in quotes because, you know, the jury's still out. But, boy, they sure look that way to me. As far as me personally, I'd really like to get my hands on that conglomerate, to be perfectly honest. It wouldn't necessarily advance our knowledge of biosignatures, but, you know, I do conglomerates. So I would like to see some of those.
Thanks a lot.
Our next question comes from David Brown. Go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. My question is, what is the one unexpected thing that you found, or maybe vice versa, that you expected to find but didn't find?
Well, not to harp too much on one thing, but on some level we expected to see rocks that were altered by fluvial activity. And we did, but it's still somehow a surprise, for especially for those of us who worked on other areas in situ on Mars, like on the Spirit site, the Opportunity site, the Phoenix site, the Pathfinder site. The first glimpse of the LINC conglomerate, all of the terrestrial geologists in the room are like, oh, it's a conglomerate. And all the rest of us are going, oh, my goodness, it's an actual conglomerate with rounded pebbles. It sounds a little boring, but to know that, yes, indeed, all of the things that we predicted, that we thought we had good evidence for, Yeah, absolutely. This is a site that was awash at one point, that was so active that, you know, things got thrown around and knocked around, but not just that, but that they had been altered by slower moving water, right? These to be able to get that fine grain stuff to really settle. So I think that was the most surprising thing for me and the most expected, if that makes sense.
Yes, thank you.
Our next question comes from Stuart Myers. Go ahead, your line is open.
Oh, hello. Nice presentation.
Thank you.
Well, anyhow, I don't know if you've been heard about this in the news, that they discovered something rather interesting with the ChemCam. And what they discovered was is that no matter what rock they shot with it, the first four shots or so, they'd always get the same information. But it was only after, like, they did the fifth shot, this thing, the rock started showing differences. I don't know if you've heard about that.
Well, I am not familiar with that particular particular possibility.
Yeah.
What I can tell you is that ChemCam is still working through a lot of its calibration. So everybody has to be a little patient with the ChemCam results. They're not as easy to intuitively understand as, you know, a snapshot. And they take some work to make the data tell you what's real, as opposed to, you know, tricks yeah. with a camera or that kind of thing. So all I would say to that is to just be a little patient as they work through the calibration issues.
Well, the article I was reading it in said that there were two theories that they were working on.
Mm-hmm.
One is that it's simply dust, that it takes four shots to blast the dust off it. And the other theory is that there's something going on with the rocks that's similar to what we have on Earth called desert varnish.
Sure.
And what's interesting about that ChemCam was that it was, believe it or not, it was predicted back in the 80s.
that wouldn't surprise me, actually.
In the book 2010, Odyssey 2, Arthur C. Clarke describes a device which is essentially a large, somewhat larger version of ChemCam, except he called it a laser telespectrometer.
Well, that would not surprise me at all.
Perfectly.
We're living in the future.
Exactly.
Thanks,
Kurt. All right.
So, and I'll just respond too that both of those hypotheses are entirely possible from a geologic standpoint. Desert varnish is you know less than it's on the millimeter scale. It's not very thick, but BLIBS doesn't get down very deep, and there's dust on everything. So either of those hypotheses sound totally reasonable to me.
All right. Wish you continued good luck with your work.
Thank you.
Again, as a reminder, please press star 1 on your phone and record your name if you have a question. Again, please press star 1 if you have a question. One moment.
I'll jump in here while we're waiting. I'm kind of amazed at how quickly the team has made these discoveries and is reporting them back to the rest of us. Is there an impetus to try and get the information out to the public as soon as possible, because we're eating it up? It seems to just be in the news all the time. I'm impressed.
It's a balance. It's a balance between knowing that data do not always say what they seem to say first thing. So we have to be careful in you know any interpretations that we come up with, but you know, a picture is a picture, and the American public bought the pictures, so the American public should have access to the pictures as soon as possible. That's why the MOLLE camera images are released immediately. When MRO sends them back to Earth, they're up on the website. So, so again, it's a balance, but it's more a balance of interpretation rather than data. For those instruments where calibration is required, it's going to take a little more time because you don't want to just dump stuff out and have it be completely uninterpretable. But for images, they come out right away. And again, it's because, you know, your tax dollars and mine at work, basically. People should have access to those.
Thank you. Thank you. I think we have time for one more question, if you don't.
Our last question comes from Mary Lou West. Go ahead. Your line is open.
Hello. It was a great presentation. I have a question about slide number 51.
Okay.
Where we see lots of terrain and different kinds of rocks and formations. I wonder if you could tell us what you think happened in that area.
Boy, I would have to be really cautious on that. I'm hesitant to hazard a guess, but the one thing I can note from this distance is it looks like you have two lines here. You have these hummocky sort of domes and hills that look layered even from where we are here. And then behind that, it looks almost like these rocks have been tilted. And I would not even know how to hazard a guess to that, because there is no plate tectonics on Mars that would do that, although there may be some local faulting and that kind of thing that would cause that. But you can see, two different types of layers. Even in this image, it looks like the layers in the back are thinner, not as thick as the layers within those mounds. So it's the only thing I would even hazard at this point is sedimentary activity. It may be the difference between, you know, fluvial episodes and aeolian or wind episodes. But that's about as far as I would go. But we're a decent distance away. If you look at the last slide, you'll see another view of that where the color's been stretched a little differently. You can see a boulder in the distance there that's the size of the Curiosity rover. Remember, again, the size of a car. So we are a long way away from there, and I'm sure I'm going to have a better idea as we get closer.
Yeah, thank you very much. It looks so tilted, I wondered if maybe that was due to the wind and the stuff in the foreground was due to water.
It could be. Could be. We'll know better as we get closer.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Dr. Yinks, it's been such a pleasure. What an amazing amount of information, and you just presented it with such... you made me laugh a couple of times out loud. I had it on mute, but I know
good.
You can't hear us from where we are out here. But thank you so much for a really great presentation. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I think that's all we have time for this evening. But before we go, I'd love to clear the lines and have a drawing for this copy of Phil Stuck's International Atlas of Mars Exploration. Operator, can you let us know how people can do that?
Yes, to enter for the drawing, we'll take, did you say call the 10th?
We'll take the 10th caller, yeah.
Perfect. So please press star 1 if you would like to enter, and we will take number 10. Again, press star 1.
And I have had this book sitting on my desk for a couple of weeks now, and I've taken a peek at it. It's really, really amazing. I have to agree. Emily from the Planetary Society reviewed it, and she says it's like an illustrated encyclopedia of Mars from all the missions from 1953 through 2003, and it's really gorgeous images. So I want to thank the Astronomical Society of the Pacific for donating this tonight. Do we have a 10th caller out there?
It looks like Joan Chamberlain,
Astronomical
Society of Northern New England.
Congratulations, Joan. I'll get that off to you this week. And that's all we have for tonight. Thank you all for joining us. You can find this telecon, along with many others on the Night Sky Network, under Astronomy Activities. Just search under teleconferences. And tonight's presentation with the full audio and written transcript will be posted by the end of next week. Thanks again, Dr. Yengst, and good night, everyone, and clear skies. And Marnie, when you read this or listen to this, safe travels to you. We're going to miss you.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.